Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition for cats and dogs. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. Feel free to email me at radiopetlady@gmail.com if you have any questions or topics you'd like Dr. Sean to cover. This show is a production of 8paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. Hello, Dr. Sean. I am so thrilled to talk to you again.
It's good to hear your voice, Tracy. How you been doing?
Well, I've been all right, but Miss Maisie, the new dog... I've never been a poop-obsessed person. You know, the dog goes to the bathroom, I clean it up, and I sort of just get on with it. But here's this dog that arrives, and people that have been listening to The Expert Vet with Dr. Donna Spector, we're going to be talking about the same issue because she's been hand-holding me through it. But what I'd love to talk about is when you have, for many people, a new dog. It probably doesn't happen so much with 8-week-old puppies that you buy directly from a quality breeder. I don't know. Maybe you get diarrhea in little tiny puppies. But those of us that get dogs from shelters, or in this case, a rehomed dog from the Weimaraner Rescue called Mid-Atlantic Weim Rescue in Virginia Beach, these dogs often will come without a digestive problem because they're on almost always one kind of kibble that often is either very cost-effective or even in some cases of a lot of shelters been given free, and the dog does okay on it. These dogs, when we adopt them, they tend to be skinny, probably healthier than the chubbiness that our own dogs have. But, you know, these places have to watch their shekels, so they feed just the right amount to keep the dog in decent condition, but kind of skinny. Well, this dog, from the minute that I tried to take her off of, and I don't mind saying the brand, because the ingredients, what do we call it again? The content label, what's that fancy word for it?
The ingredient deck?
Yeah, the ingredient deck. The ingredient deck of the Kirkland Costco brand lamb and rice and vegetable kibble. It doesn't look bad at all. It's lamb and lamb meal, and it looks perfectly nice. But it's a mass-produced, in my view, highly commercial food because it's mass-produced by I don't know who anymore for a big box store. And I'd rather use a company like Halo or your old company, Natura, you know, a high-end premium kibble as only part of the meal. That's just been what I feel good about. I want some other ingredients. And she immediately got this incredible amount of diarrhea. So many diagnostic blood tests and fecal tests and wormings and more wormings and flagyl. And at the end of the day, she still had a yucky mess, a kind of a puddle. So what it turned out to be, Dr. Donna Spector has determined, is something called fiber-responsive diarrhea. And this food, a commercial but decent food, has a lot of insoluble fiber in it. That's what makes it more cost-effective. But it turns out to be something that she absolutely needs. Like, without it, it's a puddle. So now I'm buying Kellogg's Fiber One cereal and psyllium husk, and those go in, and I'm trying to slowly transition to what I view as a higher quality kibble, a company, you know, that gives back to the community, gives back to shelters, and I want to start incorporating quote-unquote real food. So I'd love to talk about, we've talked in the past about cellulose and other kinds of fiber that go into pet food and that they're actually very expensive to produce and they have important use in a healthy dog's body. But what about fiber when you have a not well animal? I mean, she's in the peak of health other than squirting out puddles of poo.
Right. So, you know, fiber is an interesting topic because we use fiber as a generic term to describe a lot of very different things. And
the
very simplest, it's the structural components of plants that we can't digest. And so when you or I eat a meal, we eat a lot of different carbohydrates, and those carbohydrates usually fall into three categories. And I'm going to be more specific in fiber in a second, but the three main categories are fiber, starch, and sugars.
Okay.
Now, in pet food, we don't use a lot of sugars, you know, things like fructose, sucrose, things
right.
Table sugar. So most of it is coming down to being fiber or starch. And the starch component really means that our digestive enzymes, or dogs and cats, can break that down and get energy out of it, make glucose out of it. We can't make out of things like cellulose, since you brought it up, we can't get energy out of it. But there are species that can, and usually they are microorganisms very clever animals or insects that have harvested or have used those microorganisms to get energy out of it. So the cow is a perfect example of that. They have, you know, a big rumen, which is basically like a bio-fermenting tank, and it holds all these very unique bacteria that can break down the cellulose and plant material and get energy out of it. Now, they don't usually get the same types of energy that you and I think of. It's not usually glucose as much. Ultimately, they get some things called short-chain fatty acids. But the end goal is that they have a way of extracting energy from material that you or I can't. And normally, what happens is that you or I or pets will pass that fiber into our feces. Now, there's a little bit of fermentation that we do, and so there are fermentable fibers, there are non-fermentable fibers, and there are also soluble and insoluble fibers. So those are kind of the four categories of fiber when you get a little bit more specific.
Okay.
And the insoluble fiber generally is not fermentable, and the soluble fiber is generally fermentable. And fermentable just means that bugs can grow on it and do something with it. Non-fermentable means that even the special bacteria that may be in your gut or in another gut can't break it down. And so when we talk about fiber in general terms, we often are not specific enough to talk about, is it fermentable, is it non-fermentable, is it soluble, or is it insoluble? And as you rightly said, most of the time, especially in dry foods, it's insoluble dietary fiber, or fiber that is not easily digested. It's something that doesn't absorb water. And because of that, it typically adds bulk and dries feces. So if you give a lot of insoluble dietary fiber, what'll happen is that you'll get more bulk, so larger feces. Sometimes on the other end, that's helpful to make an animal feel more full when they need to lose weight loss. So you'll see it a lot of times in foods that are less energy dense.
Right.
But it's also very helpful to dry out feces. And I always have said this, and maybe I've said it before, we are much more intimately involved with our pets' feces than we are even our own. And so if you think about that, you handle, you touch, you're up close and personal with your pet's feces far more than when you defecate into the toilet.
Right.
And so we don't really think as much about our own feces and its consistency, frankly. Usually not, unless it's
all the
way to diarrhea.
Unless, or we're very sick.
Right. Right. We're very sick, or we have some medical condition.
Right.
Because it goes into a bowl of, you know, water, and we don't have to handle it, and we don't really worry about it, you know, attaching to grass or the substrate that's being defecated on. It just flushes down the toilet. And so we sometimes are a little bit less educated about the dietary effects of fiber, even on ourselves, as we do on our pets. And so as a general rule, if you want to firm up feces without even knowing what may be going on and if there's other causes, giving more insoluble dietary fiber will dry it out, add a little bit of bulk, and make it a nicer stool quality. And so most pet food companies will actually do stool quality testing. It's an actual thing you can go to a commercial laboratory and ask them to do, and you give them amount of food and they feed it, and then they score the feces on that food. And usually it's a 5-point scoring system with higher numbers. Yeah, higher numbers. Yeah, higher numbers meaning more firm, lower numbers meaning much more loose. And, you know, depending on the score of the laboratory or the kennel that you're using, you know, somewhere around a 3 or 4 is ideal. 5 is a little bit too dry, if you will. 1 is really loose pudding, and maybe even to the point of diarrhea. And so fecal score quality, stool quality, as it's usually referred to, is a very important, you know, indicator of performance. And so a lot of times for a dog or a cat food. And so people will manipulate, if you will, fiber content to enhance the stool quality. And the easiest one and the most common is you're actually worrying about it being too loose. And so you use insoluble dietary fiber. Now, a lot of that may naturally come from what you're using. You know, you might be using some, you know, grain that has a husk with it. And therefore, as you use it, you're getting natural. Or more commonly, you might actually add it as a secondary ingredient or as a separate component, because then you can modulate or control much more closely the fiber content. And so, for example, I remember one time we were formulating a food in my commercial days, and the stool quality came back, and we had our own kennel, so we were looking at the dogs, and it wasn't quite as firm as we would like. And so we had also fed it against some competitors, and you know, we wanted to make sure that our feces looked as good as others.
That's so wild.
Right?
You know, this is something that a dog owner would just never imagine is going on. It's just, you know, the other side of the mirror is just so interesting, because you were making one of the highest protein, highest quality ingredients, fancy, super high premium kibbles that exists. And even to this day, when it's been bought by other companies, I do believe it remains very much at the top of the so-called, excuse the pun, feeding chain. And yet poop quality was just as important to you as somebody selling a supermarket food. I mean, because that supposedly, I guess, makes for consumer satisfaction.
Absolutely. You know, probably the number one complaint that you will get is stool quality complaints. You know,
yes.
If all of a sudden a pet goes onto a food and it has a loose stool, that's a real concern. It's why, you know, slow transitions are always recommended, because there's a lot of other things that affect stool quality. But focusing on fiber, if we think about that, we were worried that we had a little bit too loose a stool. So we, I think in that particular case, we already used a little bit of pea fiber. Now that's a mixed source. It's the outside hull of the pea, if you will.
Okay.
And so we actually used a little bit more pea fiber and remade it, retested it, and that did the trick. And it wasn't a very large increase, but it was just enough to help things along and to keep the stool quality quite nice. And so when you look at foods, often people will say, well, I'm going to use what they provide me to determine what the fiber content is. And so crude fiber is what's reported on packaging. And that's a very poor measure, frankly, of total dietary fiber. So total dietary fiber includes the insoluble and the soluble component. It doesn't tell you about how much fermentation can occur, because that's derived from the species and actually feeding it. It just tells you you can measure the insoluble and the soluble fiber component, and that makes up total dietary fiber. Total dietary fiber is usually a much higher number than crude fiber, because crude fiber is really only measuring a portion of the insoluble fiber. And so I forwarded to you prior to our talk, because we often chat about what we might talk about,
yes,
just in preparation mentally for me, and maybe you'll share this with the readers, but I had a resident a number of years ago that I was involved in training, but I wasn't on this particular paper, who did a nice study where she took some foods, commercial pet foods, about 20 dry foods and 20 canned foods, and these are dog foods,
right,
and then had them sent out to a laboratory and measured for total dietary fiber, so measuring the insoluble and the soluble fiber component, and then comparing that to what's on the package on crude fiber, as well as what they measured as crude fiber. And as we would anticipate, the crude fiber was a really poor measure of it, so much so that I think what's interesting is that in their conclusions in this paper, they talk about that neither reported maximum nor measured crude fiber, and I'm reading directly from the study, crude fiber concentration appears to be a particularly reliable indicator of fiber concentration and composition of a given canine diet. So the one thing that tells you about fiber level on the package
doesn't really tell you about fiber level.
Correct.
And if
you shift from one direction to the other, from insoluble to soluble fiber, it could have a very profound impact. So first of all, when you look at a food and it tells you crude fiber, that's not reliable and has really very little indication of insoluble to soluble fiber. So I talked about insoluble fiber drying out the feces and making it more firm, typically adding a little bit of bulk. But soluble fiber, which we may be more familiar with, because that's typically what people self-supplement themselves
right,
is soluble fiber, psyllium seed husk. Metamucil is a trade name of Procter & Gamble, but psyllium seed husk is common. It's about a third insoluble and two-thirds soluble fiber. So in a lot of the other supplements you mix in that dissolve into, you know, your drink,
yep,
whatever, those are typically mostly soluble fiber. And soluble fiber absorbs water, it pulls water into feces, and it makes it less dry, less firm. It has a laxative effect that we would often call about it, so it would make it easier to defecate. So soluble fiber in pet foods generally are not added because you usually want, people want a very firm, you know, feces. It's not common for them. Now, there are sometimes there are cats that might benefit from a little bit softer stool, but in general, you know, they're not adding it soluble fiber to increase stool quality. Where soluble fiber is often added is mostly in canned foods, and it's added in canned foods for texture or mouthfeel. So you add soluble fiber so that you get a nice pate in your loaf of canned food,
right,
and it holds together. And that bared out in that study I was referencing by Dr. Farkas. That study showed that in general, the total dietary fiber, 83% of it was insoluble fiber in dry foods on average, and only 2/3 of it was insoluble fiber in canned foods. So a full third of it in canned foods was soluble fiber. And so that reflects, you know, what I was just saying, that in canned foods, to get that consistency, they will add a lot of soluble fibers. And you'll see that often on the label or the ingredient declaration or ingredient deck, as we started off
right,
talking about, as gums. So you'll see sometimes bar gum, you might see carrageenan or carrageenan, depending on who you ask, whether that's a hard or soft G.
Right.
Locust bean gum, xanthan gum. You'll see that also in human foods. A lot of times you'll see it in different liquids that you might want to have feel a little bit more fatty. And you go, why is that? Well, you want to have a mouthfeel that makes it feel a little bit more
rich,
thick,
sort of.
Rich, if you will. And so you'll see carrageenan or carrageenan in chocolate milk very commonly.
Interesting.
And that's to give it that little bit,
yes,
of more
that thickness.
Soluble fiber, the thickening, if you will. Yeah.
Well, then, let me just ask something. So the soluble fiber is put into some human foods and into a lot of dog canned foods so that the food itself has a nicer consistency, whereas insoluble fiber is added in order to make a better consistency of the dog or cat's stool, right?
Right. Right. If it's being added separately, it's for stool quality issues in dry foods typically. It may be there as a consequence of the grain that they're inherently using. And so if they want to have a whole grain approach, they might have the whole grain that just naturally comes when they mill the grain. It may be a component that's already there because if it's a natural grain component, it may provide a lower cost for them.
Well, that was the thing I was going to ask, is that the high-end, more premium kibble, as I understood it in my years of research, which much of it was stabbing around in the dark and in the blind because there's all kinds of emotional reactions on the part of consumers of dog and cat food to misperceived reasons for ingredients being in foods. And I think that's something that I've learned a lot about with you on this show, is that nobody was ever putting ingredients into pet food to harm a pet or to cheat a pet of good value, a good value food or a good value vitamin or mineral. It is to make some foods more affordable, and in other cases, I guess, to give you a better stool quality. But there was this bias that I had, that I gathered, if you will, from all my research, that the indigestible plant fiber that was often in food was a starchy filler, like not a good thing, like there to just use up the valuable space that high quality nutrition could have used up. And I think that there is definitely a bias towards that in kind of pet food elitists, which I would have to sort of put myself in that category, who say, well, this is a better food because of what's in it and also because of what's not in it. And yet I'm discovering that at least for this dog, and apparently there are many large breed young dogs that have a lot of digestive issues that people think are IBD and they think it's food allergy, and it's just that they need more insoluble fiber. So how do you answer that whole insoluble fiber issue?
So I definitely think that there is a lot of variability in fiber needs, and I've seen that in a lot of patients, often more so in cats than dogs, frankly. But oftentimes people want to add fiber in, and it may be to help with stool quality. And what's interesting is that it's not so clear cut as some dogs or cats need more. It's more that some need the right amount for them and the right types.
Yes.
And that's what's really tricky, because unlike a lot of things in nutrition, we have a pretty good sense. You know, if you tell me you have a patient that has, you know, kidney disease, I know roughly where we need to put protein and phosphorus. You tell me you have a patient that needs additional fiber. I don't know exactly what type that means or how much. And so individual variation becomes a very important part of this. And often we are titrating, to use a fancy chemistry term, to effect, meaning that you start a little bit, add more, watch for stool quality, and then add some more, and sometimes even change fiber types. Now, most of the time when we're adding in fiber, we're going to use a mixed source. So it's hard to find out at the store just insoluble fiber, because people don't typically need to firm their stool up. They need to soften it, if you will. And so what you can buy at the store, you'd be hard-pressed to just find powdered cellulose, which would be all insoluble fiber. So most of the time, you're going to find a mixed source, and that would be some that would have some soluble and some insoluble. When I cited the psyllium seed husk, that's two-thirds soluble, one-third insoluble.
See, I thought that the psyllium seed husk was more insoluble than soluble, and I guess I misunderstood that. It's the other way around.
No, it's more soluble than insoluble. And if you look at it, it even makes sense. If there's often on packaging with psyllium seed husk a choking warning, because it gels up so quickly.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Two things, both about in terms of, okay, you give it and then what result do you get? The stool is not a puddle, but it becomes spongy, like a kind of firm custard or something.
Right.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing for the dog's health?
Well, that's the soluble fiber taking, you know, its role of, it's going to absorb the water so it doesn't just leak out, if you will.
Right.
It'll hold it together. It gels. And you can see this. You can put some psyllium seed husk or Metamucil
in water and it turns into that same, pudding.
Yeah, pectin has a similar impact. Pectin is mostly soluble fiber, but that's why we use it to make, you know, and I'm going to get my jellies and preserves and jams.
But that's right. No, but it's true.
But we use pectin, which is a soluble fiber, for that same reason.
That's right.
It gels up and after it cools down. And so I think that the thing to remember about, you know, adding fiber in is that we haven't talked about this whole other realm, which we've become much more aware of, which is fermentability. And so if a fiber is fermentable, which generally means it's also soluble, because it's hard for the bacteria to act on things that don't have water around it. That's a very gross simplification.
Okay.
But if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. You use this dry thing.
Right.
But if you have soluble fiber that is also fermentable, that feeds the gut flora, or the fancy word we now use is microbiota. And that's all the things that live in our GI tract. And giving the right fiber types helps promote certain bacteria to grow and flourish. And some of those have beneficial health effects. Now, we're still learning a great deal about that. But the idea of prebiotics, you hear a lot about probiotics, which are bugs that you feed to yourself, whether it be yogurt or, you know, some supplement. But prebiotics is the other category, which really mean fermentable fibers. Fibers that feed the microbiota, the flora, that we used to call it the gut flora, the bacteria in the GI tract, and they have a beneficial effect. And so what you don't know is that when you're changing the fiber, not only are you changing how much water can be absorbed or how much water isn't absorbed, how firm the stool will be, but you're also changing the GI flora by feeding it. And so sometimes beneficial effects that we see are not solely related to the physical properties of the fiber, how well it gels or doesn't, but also how you're changing the flora and how much you're feeding that flora. And that can have profound beneficial effects to the GI tract as well. Some, for example, GI bugs produce something called glutamine, which is a amino acid that is very beneficial to the enterocytes, which is the cells lining the intestinal tract. Entero just means intestinal, if you will. Site is another word for cell. So you can see where the word enterocyte comes from. But the cells lining the GI tract are very responsive to energy sources that come from the bacteria. So glutamine comes from the food we eat. There's some effects on short chain fatty acids commonly that we talked about when we were saying about cows. There's still some short chain fatty acids that the enterocytes can use as an energy source. So they have a very interesting role to play by helping the lining of our GI tract be more healthful. And then there's even some more interesting work that's beyond my area of expertise, where there's immune mediating effects of probiotics and prebiotics. And so if there is an abnormal immune response, sometimes you can help that immune response in the GI tract by giving it the right fiber types and the right and helping the right bugs grow in the GI tract. So we're learning more and more. And so I think that the simplification of just looking at crude fiber on the label, which obviously doesn't tell us a whole lot about the fiber amount or the more importantly, the type of fiber, but then taking even another step, what the fermentability of that fiber type is and how that's affecting our gut flora, we really don't know. And that's why I think all this individual variation plays a role, because you're often looking and saying, well, I'm going to add this fiber or this fiber, but you really don't know what you're adding. And you really don't know what it's doing to the GI tract at all. And so you have to really feed it to then monitor response. And that's where we're left with. And some animals do great on lots of fiber if it's the right type. Some need very little. So if we were to take another animal and put them on, you know, too much fiber, they might get diarrhea as well. And so you could overshoot your target, if you will.
Well, that's the thing that's very confusing, because I have celiac sprue disease. And anyone that has that kind of a very reactive to any sort of grain gut knows that you just have to avoid anything with gluten in it. But you still have, you know, there can be that random time if you eat anywhere but at your house when you can get kind of influenced, or you already have a gut that's very reactive from years of being not properly diagnosed. And the gastroenterologist told me that I should be having morning and night lots of soluble fiber, which is that kind of benefiber, that thing that dissolves in the water, for the opposite reason of a laxative, the more of the firming, more of the slowing down. It's really not so much about what comes out, but how the gut works. Does it slow it down? Does it make such rapid transit time, as it's been referred to?
Yeah, so transit time is affected by fiber amount too, and that's a whole other area where you can slow down transit time or speed it up with fiber amounts and fiber types. And so that plays a whole other role. And you can imagine that if you are having your feces pass through your GI tract too quickly, the colon can't absorb the water out of it quick enough, so it ends up being a higher moisture feces, and that can be a problem. So changing transit time can have a big impact. The other thing that, you know, you're alluding to with fiber is that dietary fiber and amount of dietary fiber can have effects on absorption of nutrients too.
That's the part that I was concerned about, particularly with the dog. The sense that if it was going right through her, so to speak, that she didn't, it wasn't having a chance to be utilized as energy and goodness.
Right. And we know that fibers, they can affect, and the most classic one that we think about with fiber in veterinary medicine is effects on glucose uptake. And so you can manipulate how readily absorbed in a diabetic the glucose in the diet is by changing fiber. And so some of the highest fiber foods are made specifically for diabetics, because you're trying to slow glucose uptake by gelling that glucose, making it harder to be absorbed, changing times. And then there's other concerns about mineral uptake and some other trace minerals that can be affected by fiber level. Taurine deficiency was often thought about as a potential concern as well, because it has another impact, which is it causes more bile acid loss. Bile acids being conjugated with taurine, which is an amino acid that if you don't make enough of it or have enough of it, causes
like cats
heart failure.
Don't. Right.
Yeah, cats can cause heart failure. And so one of the risk factors of a taurine deficiency is a very high fiber diet, because it causes more bile acids to be lost in the feces, because the fiber basically latches onto the bile acids and you don't get to reabsorb the bile acids and recirculate and reuse your taurine. And so high fiber diets can have an impact on absorption of certain nutrients or reabsorption of nutrients, if you will. So there's a lot of things that fiber is doing that makes it more complex than just looking at, oh, this bag has more crude fiber than the other bag.
And what about the Fiber One cereal, which Dr. Donna said has the highest fiber?
It's incredibly rich. You know, I looked it up because I hadn't looked at this in a while, but the highest food that I'm aware of is a food from Hill's that is a high fiber food. It has whopping amounts of fiber, and it's designed for diabetics mainly. It's, if you figure it out, and
is that the WD?
That's WD. It has about
Donna had spoken about that.
Yeah, it's about 54 to 55 grams per 1,000 calories of fiber.
Right.
And I don't know if that's total dietary fiber. If we assume 80% of it is insoluble, based on Dr. Farkas' study, it may be up to 66 grams per 1,000 calories. Fiber One is 233 grams of total dietary fiber per 1,000 calories. So it's appears that it could be as much as four times as much on an energy basis as the highest food available to
that's medicinal. So that's
medicinal.
So that gives you great ability to add the fiber, but then as we wrap up, then it still becomes a balancing act, and I don't think I've got the balance right, which is with each meal you give some of the psyllium husk and you give the fiber one just twice a day in a quarter of a cup. But then if you don't get firm stool, does it mean you could be overdoing it?
That's possible. That's why usually I'm very cautious if I can, and I start with a very small amount, wait for a few stool or bowel movements, look at the stool quality, and then if needed, keep on going and adding more if things are improving, because at some point you will actually get a diminishing return and you'll actually cause the stool to become softer again.
That's, I think, what's happened. I've gone out the back door and around the alley. So then you have to back off, but using both of them isn't a bad idea.
Well, I'm more of a one variable kind of guy.
Okay.
And so I don't like to have two things that I have to worry about. Maybe it's my simplistic nature. So often I will use one and see if I can have one work for me. And if I can get good stool quality. And I usually, if I'm just trying to get firmer stools, I'll preferentially use something that is richer in insoluble fiber. I might even have someone special order powdered cellulose if that's what I'm trying to do.
Wow. But between the fiber one and the psyllium, which would you lean towards if you were going to just be the single guy?
I have had more experience with psyllium seed husk than fiber one. So because of that, I might lean to it, even though I know it's more soluble fiber, just because I know what to expect and I've used it more.
Okay,
but that's not to say that fiber one might not be a good choice.
Right.
Just I don't use it as much personally.
I have both, and I keep thinking, well, if I could just add more, this stuff will firm up, and it gets more and more like, some horrible pudding served in a nursing home. I don't mean to be gross, but it's weird. It, just gets more and more.
You might have gone too far.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting thing for people to realize. This is not something to fool around with on your own. And even though your vet may be able to work with Balance It or can work with a veterinary nutritionist, it still involves a lot of owner participation in eyes and ears and feedback and willingness to give less or more until you get to the place you want to be.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. Well, you know what? I know there's many other people dealing with the challenge I'm dealing with German Shepherd dogs and English Bulldogs. There's just so many breeds that have all kinds of digestive flights of fancy. So it's really good to know that fiber can be one's friend, but has to be used thoughtfully and sparingly, perhaps even. Thank you, Dr. Sean. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good, Tracy.
Thank you all for listening. Wishing you all happy meals for your pets. We'll be with you next week.